Dark Reef Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. Autumn Semester 2009, this is Business Finance FIL 240, Section 6. Lecture 5, delivered on September 1 of 2009. The title of this lecture is The Structure of an Interest Rate.
Today, the structure of an interest rate. I begin by briefly reviewing the Federal Reserve System, only for the purpose of addressing how important the Federal Reserve is, certainly in the short run and in the intermediate run, to interest rates. Interest rates are a dominant topic in finance, regardless of which branch of finance you're talking about. For this course, they would be used for discounting cash flows. Now, when I use the term interest rate, I am referring to sort of a diffuse thing. There are all kinds of interest rates. Discount rate, the effective rate, APR, rate of return, return on investment, return on assets, yield. Just any number of different terms could fall under interest rate. They all have the same feature, though, that they are usually a number between 0 and 1, and we express them as a percentage. Now, if you're doing manual calculations by formula, you would obviously turn a percentage into a decimal. You would just do that automatically. Strangely, though, most calculators want you to enter the information of an interest rate as an interest rate, as a percentage, which creates sort of a difficulty sometimes that you might have a tendency to convert it to a decimal to put it into a calculator, and the calculator, financial calculators probably don't want it that way. So you got to watch yourself a little bit with that distinction between what is the real mathematical object, which is a decimal, and the percentage, which is that decimal times 100. Now, interest rates, again, are a dominant feature of finance. And when you use interest rates, whatever it is, like a discount rate for a cash flow, or when you calculate the rate of return on an investment or an internal rate of return, it is important for you to understand what this animal is. It's not just a lump. It has meaning internally. And that internal meaning is driven by factors of the macroeconomy, sometimes by micro factors. Most importantly, it is driven by, as a single identifiable thing that affects interest rates. I can tell you that the Federal Reserve is a driving force of interest rates. So too is the federal government. As the government runs budget deficits, it hits the global capital markets. It must. It borrows its money, and the federal government has no sensitivity. It has zero sensitivity to the level of interest rates. So it will just hit them as hard as it needs over and over, regardless of how much interest rates are going up as a result of its hits. Now, when you borrow money for your house someday, it could be a $500,000 dream home. Probably not, but it could be. And your hit to the capital markets will be meaningless. $500,000 isn't even a blip on the radar of the global capital markets. It really isn't. It's irrelevant. You will not affect interest rates with your borrowing. You will not affect interest rates with your savings and your investments. Governments do. Especially large governments, like the government of the United States, the government of a country like Russia or China, The government, the governing body of the European Union, yeah, they do. When they need money, they borrow money. If they borrow excessively, it will drive up interest rates, because as they supply debt instruments to the market as borrowers, remember that they are the suppliers, the supply increases, which drives down the price. And as the price goes down, the yield goes up by that locked mathematical relationship. So you've got this nasty effect at the macro level. We have a government now which has, as a matter of policy, it's borrowing money with the intent of stimulating the economy through the expenditures that it will direct from the use of that money. However, as it is borrowing money, it is going to put pressure on global capital markets. It's supplying large, huge amounts of debt to the market, which drives down the price of the debt, which drives up interest rates, the yield on that debt, which drives up all yields. And therefore, as those yields go up, as you saw in the last lecture, that cuts off private investment. So effectively, in trying to save the economy, the dilemma is that you can actually hurt the economy. By using stimulative fiscal policy that is debt-driven, you actually cause interest rates to go up. But as interest rates go up, that kills business investment. So essentially, we are in one way, we are trading off public expenditures for private stimulus. In that way, the question is the balancing act. How does it work? But here's the second part of the problem. We have the Federal Reserve, the Central Bank of the United States, which has the ability to buy the government debt to blunt the effect that government debt has on private global capital markets. Or on global capital markets. I don't want to say private, because central banks buy a lot of our debt, lend us money. But this is a load, and I'm going to have to go through this a couple of times for you, and I do layer these kinds of lectures like this. This predicate has a lot of complexity to it, and I appreciate that. But here's the thing. When we borrow money, when our government borrows money, it puts upward pressure on interest rates because it's tapping global capital markets. Our central bank can step in, literally print money, and go to the Treasury auctions and take that debt off the table, buy it up, and that means that the borrowing is not hitting the global capital markets. So what's the problem with that? It is a road to ruin if it is done too long. Historically, if it is done modestly and under controlled circumstances, cabining how long it's going to happen, it can actually work. That's neo-Keynesian policy. If it goes on too long, though, too much money, if the growth rate of the money supply exceeds the real growth rate of the economy, there is one and only one result. And I'm going to ask you, given that I assigned a couple of articles, can you tell me, one and only one effect comes when the growth rate of the money supply exceeds the real growth rate of the economy? What is it?
Recession.
No. Nice try. Would you like to give it?
Inflation.
Bingo. Inflation. There is no other way out. It will become inflation unless the Federal Reserve claws that money back before it begins to water down the value of each dollar. But if the Federal Reserve prints money and that money is not usable for real transactions of the real economy, it will become inflation. It will. There is no other way out. No fantasy, no myth of any Republican or Democrat can change that basic reality. And that basic reality has been, as you saw in those articles, that our money supply has been growing at an excessive rate, far above the real growth rate of our economy, for at least 5 years. In fact, before that, it was growing for a while in the early days of the Bush administration under accommodative monetary policy of Alan Greenspan's Fed. It was growing rapidly then, too, fueling the growth of the economy for a while, but then beginning to create inflation, which immediately when Bernanke came to power. He declared that the accommodative policy of the Fed was at an end. That was a lie. He crushed the money supply very quickly and then quietly began to unleash M2 and M3 while he continued to choke M1. And the result, as you have seen, as you read, and as I predicted, was a global financial crisis. And we have not even seen the beginning of the real crisis, which will be when all of that excess liquidity, which is now building again at a staggering rate with M1, begins to create inflation. Because sooner or later, once the inflation starts, there has to be a solution. And the solution hurts like hell the longer you wait to enact the solution. That's the end of that for now. I'm going to come back to it and talk about the execution of monetary policy through open market operations. But for the time being, I want to take you a little bit deeper into what I mean by the interest rate. There really isn't the interest rate. There are interest rates. You know very well there are different kinds of interest rates. There's the interest rate on a car loan. There's the interest rate on a home loan. There's the interest rate on credit card debt. There's the interest rate that I would charge you if you bummed $20 off me. You wouldn't like that one. But here's the deal. When I talk about an interest rate, all interest rates have a core. Essentially, there is a seed interest rate underneath all interest rates. Unfortunately, that's actually theoretical. We can't actually see it. We can't see it. There are econometric models we can use to estimate this animal, this small core at the bottom. And certainly the models have gotten very good, and I even did some of that work too in econometrics studies. But at the heart of every interest rate, down there in the very bottom, is what we call the real interest rate. The real interest rate. The problem with actually catching this animal, physically taking a snapshot of the real animal itself, is that its definition is a little bit fuzzy. Here's the thing. The real interest rate is the opportunity cost of foregone consumption. It's the opportunity cost of foregone consumption at its very heart. The opportunity cost. What you give up in a very short period of time for having money in the bank or somewhere. You have to be rewarded. Really? If someone wants my $20, they're going to have to reward me for not getting my cheeseburgers. It's going to hurt. Someone's going to have to pay for that. Really. I should like to have you give me money for free. Are you going to do that?
For a grade, yeah.
No. And this idea that, well, banks rip people off by charging. Oh, stop it. No rational entity, agent, thing will give up something for nothing. There is an opportunity cost involved. There really is. It is a positive cost. That's what we're talking about here. Now, in a little more practical sense, this real interest rate would be driven by the supply of and demand for money. It would be driven by the model that you saw in macroeconomics. We would have a quantity and a price of money. Now, the price of money is the interest rate. It's the rental rate on money. Interest rate is a rental rate on money. So R. So we would have a demand curve downward sloping, which actually might have something of a curving behavior to it. This would be the demand for money. The quantity of money is down here on the horizontal axis. Now, at any given point in time, the Federal Reserve will have a stock of money in the economy. That's the vertical line representing that this is not something that has supply upward. It's not upward sloping. There's just a fixed amount of money at a snapshot point in time. There's a fixed amount of money. And the interaction of those two will establish an interest rate. Now, in a very short period of time, that could very well be described as the real interest rate, the opportunity cost of giving up your money, renting it, the opportunity cost of rent. You live somewhere, right? You don't live on the street. Okay, there's an opportunity cost you would have of giving up your place to live. You would charge a rental rate. Same thing with money. There'd be an opportunity cost of giving up your money. That would be the rental rate of money, which we call the interest rate. But this thing, it's tough. And I don't want to get too far into this, but if the money supply is growing too fast, this real interest rate begins to get hazed over by a secondary effect where the money becomes worth less in an inflation kind of way. So I caution that this is a very short snapshot in time. We cannot see it. We really can't see it because at any given point in time, there is that fuzzy thing that is around it. Now, at any given point in time, let me try this. Here. You work for me, sir, and you've seen that inflation has been kind of building, and I'm here for your pay review, and I'm looking at, you do a good job here, and I think I've been paying you $5 an hour, so I think I should pay you more. Well, it looks like last year inflation was running at 4%. So I'm going to give you a 4% increase in your wage. Now that might sound reasonable at first, but what happens if over the past 3 years inflation has gone from 1% to 2% to 4%? How do you feel about that 4% raise now? Yeah, because you see that interest rate, that inflation rate has been accelerating upward. Over the course of when you will be making now $10.40 an hour, there is some expectation on your part that you will lose ground to inflation because inflation will be growing faster than 4%. In financial markets, we don't screw around with the past. All that matters in a financial market is the expectation of the future. That's all that matters, is an expected, not an actual of historical significance. Well, suppose that inflation has been roaring, moving up, up, up. It's gotten to 10%, and you're coming back for your pay review. And I said, well, I'm going to give you a 2% raise next year. And I know you feel a little bad about that, but I just saw the news, and Ben Bernanke, the Fed chairman, says he's going to get tough with inflation. And I believe Ben. How does that make you feel? An intention? A promise? Would you base your financial decisions on promises and intentions of some hoe handle with a bald head and a sappy look on his face? Oh, I'm sorry, I'm getting a little political there. No, you see, it does not matter. You don't assume intentions, you assume capabilities. What is the financial market's capability? What is the trend? What is the future as far as I can, in my best estimate, tell? I do not base my decisions on history. I base them on capabilities of the future. So when I write this additional premium here that I'm about to write, this is an expectation. Now, traditionally, we have written this as the letter, the small Greek letter pi with a little e on it. That is expected inflation premium. So every interest rate at its core carries a real opportunity cost of foregone consumption plus an expectation of the erosion of that interest rate. I would like to pay you 10% on money I borrow from you. Well, inflation next year is going to be 15%. You're going to lose money. unless you impound that inflation premium that you expect. You expect that inflation premium. So you are not going to be stupid. You're going to put, otherwise, I make out like a bandit on this loan. That's why inflations, by the way, are great for borrowers, terrible for lenders. Because a roaring inflation erodes the face value of debt. That's why we don't like inflations in financial markets, because they hurt the lenders. Borrowers just love themselves some inflation, because if you've got a home loan with an outstanding balance of $100,000, you've got, say, 10 years of 8% inflation. Look at what that does to erode the value of that, the actual purchasing power of that $100,000 you're giving back to the bank. It's pretty much worthless to the bank after that much time. So bankers certainly do not want inflation. So any banker, any investor worth his salt is going to try to abate, mitigate that by impounding an expected inflation premium into an interest rate. All interest rates will carry this animal right here, this expected inflation premium. All interest rates will carry it. They will carry these two things, a real rate of return on investment plus an expected inflation premium. Together, these two beasts are what we call the risk-free rate, which I write as an R sub F. The risk-free rate comprises the real rate of return and the expected inflation premium. Now, the dynamics of this can get nasty. Because if interest rate, if you've got a bad hard inflation that goes on too long in an economy, this SOB right here becomes embedded, this expected inflation premium. So you can make all the promises in the world and the financial markets will say, bite me, we're not getting rid of it. So literally, if the Federal Reserve has been running a loose monetary policy too long, trying to keep our real down, it will begin to lose because pi e will begin to rise, countervailing the r real that the Fed is trying to keep low with excess money supply growth. Then the nasty thing will happen, as happened in 1980, when we finally, President Jimmy Carter at the time finally appointed a hardcore bitch as Federal Reserve Chairman, Paul Volcker. God, I hope he's still alive. I hope he never hears me call him that. You'd probably think I was his friend. A very vicious man. He just clamped down the money supply. He just said, enough of this. We're going to claw it in. We're just going to boom, like that. Look what happened to the real interest rate. So this guy skyrocketed. Financial markets didn't believe him. This thing was still way up there in the air. So you had all interest rates in insane territory. Mortgages, 20%, 25% home loan mortgages. It was insane. Volcker just held on until the markets finally began to drain out their expectation of inflation and pi e began to fall. And then, after a couple of years, could Volcker's Fed begin to let go of the money supply and allow it to grow a little bit more to bring this down. But boy, you want to talk about a hard recession? That was a nasty one, simply because interest rates skyrocketed, because Volcker crushed our real. Volcker crushed the money supply, which drove this one through the roof, and that meant that, but no one believed that it was going to stick. We'd heard Fed chairmen say this all along. Yeah, we're going to get tough with inflation. We had Gerald Ford. He thought it was like he could have buttons made everyone should wear. Whip inflation now. Win. It got even worse with Jimmy Carter. He got up there in front of the American people and he said, I see inflation as the moral equivalent of war. M-E-O-W. Real, not very good. But yeah, go ahead.
Oh, it was.
And that's the awful thing. There was no other way to do it. Essentially, there is no magic. And every now and then I read these books where they say, well, this was cruel and it was the evilest way to do it. Naomi Klein wrote a book that's Shock Doctrine, which criticizes this way of dealing with inflation that has been used in other countries and in the United States. There's no other way. It cannot be done any other way. Now, what I'm reading in the business literature right now, kind of this rah-rah approach. Well, if we have brilliant people at the helm of the Fed, what they can do is slowly claw in the money supply
so as not to cause R real to jump fast, and that we can do it in such a way that pi e will not go through the expected inflation premium, will not embed. Surely the masterful Fed can accomplish this over the next 18 months. And then I see, oh, they just reappointed Ben Bernanke. We're screwed. We're dead. No, but really, if you get in front of it fast enough, you can't put the brakes on slowly. You could. I have rarely seen monetary policy carried out by any Fed where they did that. They always waited until it was too late to do a gentle landing, and then it had to be a hard landing. The dilemma is that, and I don't get me wrong, I'm not criticizing Obama. He's a bright, bright man. What really scares me is that it's going to end up playing exactly like it did with Carter, where Carter finally had his chance in 80 by appointing Volcker. And, of course, he sent us into a recession, and everyone just kicked that poor son of a bitch out of office. And that it's building toward that same time frame where the shock, but unfortunately, Bernanke's not the kind of guy who has the toughness of Paul Volcker. However, interestingly enough, Obama has put Paul Volcker, now he's an ancient fossil, on his economic advisory board. I mean, I didn't realize the guy was still alive, but there he is. I control the universe. You have failed me for the last time, Bernanke. So there is that power in there. A huge, tall, we call him Tall Paul, huge, very tall man, big, fat man, who smoked these disgusting cigars. The story was he would blow the cigar smoke in people's face just to show them that who was boss. He might have the moral power to walk into the Federal Reserve's chamber and just make people stop breathing. He can do that, from what I've heard. But my last time down at the Federal Reserve, they had this confab, and they didn't have me at the last one. But the one before that, I tried to challenge, how are you going to deal with this? What are you going to do? And then I was talking on a talk show on CNN, and a radio talk show, and a reporter who claimed he was a real insider at the White House and with the Fed, I said, are they talking about how to solve this massive overhang of money? And he said, no. He said, all they care about is stopping the financial crisis. They are putting those problems down the road. Okay, that's the way it's going to play. It's going to come out bloody. Now, let me take you further. Every interest rate will have this R sub F embedded in it. Unfortunately, because R real is a theoretical animal, we can't see it at any given point in time because it will never be separated from pi e. We would never see a pure real interest rate. We just will never see one. It will always have this mixed in. And this, we can estimate the expected inflation rate by doing surveys and all that, but even there, we can look at financial instruments and try to separate out effects and maybe tease out what this animal is. But still, this thing is slightly diffuse. We can get our hands on it, though. There is a proxy. There is a proxy for this. There is a real financial instrument out there that roughly approximate the risk-free rate, R sub F. And we use it all the time in econometric modeling and all that. I use it. Just about everyone uses this proxy. It's not exactly R sub F, but it is damn close. It is a one-year treasury bill. It's a treasury bill. Short-term government debt instrument. Look, the government will never default on its debt. It will not. I have these friends and fellow, some of them I actually have as writers on one of my heavy websites, that, well, the government's going to default on its debt next year. And then some idiot actually sent me, he's got a Facebook group where he's encouraging the government to default on its debt. They want the government to default on its debt. That'll clean up our problems with our debt. First of all, putting it on Facebook, that's not going to give it a whole lot of credibility. Second of all, he actually put up a comment on one of my articles telling people to jump on board the idea of the government defaulting on its debt so we can get out of this debt problem right away. Just go bankrupt. And I was harsh. I can't remember, but I think every word I used when I responded to him began with mother. Idiot. Anyway, we're not going to ever default on the debt. So there would be no default premium. And you'll see that in a bit. I'm sneaking these in. It is short term. So there would be no maturity premium. And treasury bills are extraordinarily liquid. You can trade those at any time. As a matter of fact, the best money market mutual funds have lots of this stuff in them because just boom, it can be turned into money. They're extremely liquid, so there's no illiquidity premium in them. So in a sense, this a short-term treasury debt instrument, whatever the yield shows up at any given point in time, that's a good approximation of the risk-free rate, which we'll come back later in this course. You're going to see the risk-free rate is very important because essentially every instrument, every financial instrument out there that provides you with some reward must have at its heart at least the risk-free rate. It must have at least the risk-free rate. So if you told me that the yield on a T-bill, the annualized yield on a T-bill right now is 0.2%, I know that there should be no instrument that would provide you with less than 0.2%. That would be the rock bottom. 0.2% would be the embedded base underneath all interest rates. It would sit there as essentially the stop, below which no interest rate. Why would you invest in anything that provided you with less than 0.2% if you can purchase and get 0.2% for a perfectly safe, perfectly liquid, short-term treasury bill? There would be no reason, no logic. So essentially, this is the substrate underneath all interest rates. And then we walk on. So we've got this animal, and you're going to see this guy again several times in the course. One place we see it is in the capital asset pricing model. Whenever we work out what we call a discount rate, that's the rate we use to drop back cash flows in the future to the present. When we work out what interest rate we're going to use to do that pullback, that clawback of future cash flows to their present value, we always, always have R sub F in there. It is actually part of the formula called the capital asset pricing model. The R sub F, you see, it's the first term. R sub F will be there. The risk-free rate will be there, and then we calculate an added premium to it. But for now, let's work on here. We've got this, the base. Now, all interest rates other than the short-term debt instruments of the government will carry one or more of the following three premia. And they could be of different sizes. These premia could. The first one that I will bring up to you is R sub D, the default premium. This is a reward for the expectation of the probability, that part or all of the obligation will not be satisfied. That part or all of the obligation will not be satisfied. In other words, this is just a premium added on for the possibility that you are not going to pay off, the borrower is not going to pay off part or all of the loan. Now, the default premium varies with respect to the instrument. For example, something, a debt that is collateralized, would have a lower default premium than debt that has no collateral. Just logical. Because if I can claim your house, well, that helps out a whole lot. But if I cannot claim your house, if I am just essentially hoping that you'll pay me, boy, that's a little dangerous. You guys, many of you get student loans. Those have a very low default premium because the government promises the banks that it will cover it if you default. So there is a very low default premium there because the government's going to cover it. They are underwriting. They are guaranteeing your loans, as long as it's in some kind of a government program, the loan is. And therefore, the banks can charge you a lower rate than they otherwise would. That's just how that's just the way it is. Thank God for that. Otherwise, you'd be paying enormous amounts just because of the default premium, because essentially some of you are just, you would default on it. And of course, the government stepping in can scare the hell out of you with all the things it'll do to you if you don't pay. So that really shapes you up too. And so essentially, if this guarantee program weren't there, you'd be paying an enormous amount in default premium because you're young, your cash flow, future cash flow might be expected to be high, but there's a lot of risk in it because a lot of you will spend years without jobs, homeless, on the streets, selling your body, and things, or probably not on that one, but clearly, though, it would be a very high premium. Look, credit cards have very high interest rates. I mean, you look at the credit card interest rates most people pay. The APR is 18%. It's really high. And that's just because there's a higher probability of default. There's no collateralization for a lot of those cards. And so they charge a high default premium to cover the losses from all the fools who will default. Now, that's the default premium. It varies with respect to the debt instrument. It varies with respect to the debt instrument. Now, the next one is the maturity premium, R sub M. Now, the maturity premium is kind of an interesting animal. Debt can be of all kinds of lengths. Remember I told you about bills, notes, bonds, all that kind of stuff. Look, think about this. Suppose that I lend you money. Now, I could lend you money for 1 year, and then we might renew it on a new contract. You really need the money for 20 years. But every year, I want you to pay it back, and then I rewrite the loan. You don't actually even have to pay me back. We just work it out so that the loan is essentially rewritten and you get the money again. Or I could just lend you the money for 20 years. Now let's think about 20 years. Suppose that I lend you the money at 10%. Interest rates fall to 5%. Sometime, surely over 20 years, there is a much higher probability of any given event, right? So over 20 years, there's a pretty darn good chance that interest rates could go to 5% or 6%. Well, if interest rates go to 5% over the life of your loan with me at 10%, rationally, what would you probably try to do?
Get a lower interest rate.
Yes, borrow from someone else at 5% and then give me my money back. Here you go, sucker. I was kind of hoping for my 10% for 20 years. You're not going to do that. What about, let's be fair and let's be love each other. You're going to say, screw you, no. Okay, now let's take it the other way. I lend you money at 10%. Now, over the life of that 20-year loan, interest rates go up to 20%. How do I feel as the lender? Would you like to kind of like pay me off so I can like lend the money again to someone else? What are you going to say to that? No, you're going to say, bite me. Technically, that's a financial term. No, I'm not going to do that. Do you see that as the term of a debt instrument gets longer, the probability of adverse events up and down gets greater? Because over 20 years, there's more chance of something adverse to me as the lender happening. And it's not just adversity on one side, it's two-sided adversity. If interest rates go down, you're going to refi with someone else, and I'm left with 5% money when I was expecting 10% over 20 years. On the other hand, if interest rates go up, I'm sitting here, boy, I'd sure like to be making 20% on my money, but I can't because you greedy capitalist running dog, are going to hold on to that loan. We see this fascinating in home markets. When in high interest rates, and we expect the typical homeowner home loan to end maybe about 7 years. That's typical for a home loan because of moves or something like that. But when interest rates go up, people hold on to their loans longer. Why? Because their loan is more valuable to them. They're getting an additional cash flow, essentially, because they don't have to borrow at a higher rate. When interest rates go down, the life of the typical loan, home loan, shortens because people just refi their brains out. That's why we charge points and fees to try to make it less desirable to refi when interest rates go down. We want to make it so that interest rates have to go down a lot before it becomes worth refi. Okay, that's the maturity premium. Now, last one. Now, I have always called this, and this is, I don't know, maybe I've just not seen the right books, but the book calls this the illiquidity premium. I've always called it the liquidity premium, but I'll stick with the book's definition, but I'll still stick with my label, R sub L. It actually is an illiquidity premium. And it's actually not complicated. It's very simple. Let's see. I need a napkin. I don't have a napkin. Well, why don't I just do it this way? Okay. I want you to imagine two people. Find someone who looks really respectable. The gentleman in the back wearing a tie is actually almost distracting. Look at this. Very respectable looking. I mean, the man is just exuding State Barn. I mean, he qualifies as cougar bait. He is... Sorry. Beat red. You crossed your legs there, son. He needs to borrow some money. And you are the respectable lender. That's in capitals, respectable lender. Now, he comes to you and he wants to borrow $100 for a year. Let's say on a discount note. You'll lend him a certain amount and he'll pay you back $100 a year. See how that's a discount? It'll work like a T-bill. And there are actually some loans. And you say, okay, well, perhaps I shall lend you $940. Okay, now. And he's already prepared the paperwork and it's all formal and legal and all that. Looks really nice. And then I come into you. And I'm rather scruffy looking. Wait. And I come in. How you doing there? I like some money for some booze or food. I'll hook you back up in a year. Yeah, I'll pay $100 back in 1 year. I'm gonna write you here a promissory note. I owe you $100, and I didn't even sign it. What the hell's my name? Oh yeah, there. There's your damn note, a promissory note, and it's legal too. I took a business law course. That's a legal instrument. It is. It actually would be under certain conditions. Now, you're obviously in the business of lending money, so you're going to lend me some money. Are you going to lend me $940 like you did that fellow back there?
Well, your credit's probably better.
My credit's better?
Maybe.
You don't know that. I'm a street person. Oh, stop it. Just use your gut. Use gut. Use animal instinct. Are you going to lend me $940 coming in off the street, fleas flying around me, the slight smell of MD and funk, and this could happen. I mean, and you'll hear me coughing, and every now and then I bitch because I've coughed up a tumor. And You're not going to lend me $940. I'd be lucky if you lent me $50 out of your purse just to get me out of, because I'm scaring the customers. Okay? You see, remember that as the price goes down, the yield goes up. You see, the chance that I'm going to pay her back is just ludicrous. Low. So there's going to have to be a higher yield. Just because, but there's another reason too. You see that loan? Suppose that you needed that money before a year was up. You could sell that instrument. There are liquid markets that buy debt instruments. That's what we're going to do a lot in this course, is look at those secondary markets where loans are bought and sold. Heck, you can even sell accounts receivable. There are companies that will buy those. All kinds of debt are saleable. So if you needed your money back before a year, which one of these instruments is going to be more likely to pay you to be sellable very quickly? The one from him? Yes. This little promissory note I scratched out on a scrap of paper isn't going to be worth the paper. No one's going to buy that. This was also, by the way, one of the things that I saw in stocks. I did penny stocks. If I wanted to sell some Microsoft stock, boom, I could have just called up any broker in the country just instantly. I could have probably sold it to someone on the street. But when I was dealing with penny stocks, where there was a thin market, there might be four market makers, none of whom anyone had ever heard of, and no one recognized the name of the company, it could actually, when someone wanted to sell that stock, it could literally be weeks before I could find some sucker or some buyer to buy that stock. Therefore, in a situation like that, I am going to offer a lower price. If a seller comes to me and says, "You as a dealer, will you buy my stock? I bought it at $1. I'm going to say, fine, I'll buy it from you, but at a very low price because it's going to take me forever to find someone to buy that from me, from my inventory. So that the illiquidity premium is going to be tacked on for securities that do not have complete, thick, dense markets for resale. The illiquidity premium is a reward for the possibility that the security cannot be sold if needed in a timely fashion. Taken all together with this baseline of the risk-free rate, and then this risk structure here, the R sub D, R sub M, R sub L, you would see that there could be all kinds of different rates in an economy, all of them underneath it carrying a risk-free rate, but then each one being tailored to the specifics of the instrument that is being we're talking about. So we would have these coming into play as risk premia to reward investors, to induce them to invest in the instrument. And put together, that is what comprises a market interest rate. So from here on out, I will talk about interest rates. I do not want a simplistic knowledge, which can happen in a finance course. They can just go, well, let's use this interest rate. Let's attack this interest rate. Let's calculate this interest rate. Instead, I want you to have the nuanced understanding. What's going on inside of an interest rate? Because that can help you understand what drives an economy. You brought up something a little earlier about macroeconomic and how we can control the descent of the money supply and all of that. Think about this. What's happening with home loan defaults right now? Are they high or low? Are people defaulting lots on loans or a little bit on loans? In fact, it's the highest it's been in years, almost in recorded history, the default rates on loans. So what's that going to do to the default premium that lenders charge on loans? Push it up. Do you see how that will actually tend to work against any efforts by the Federal Reserve to suppress this and keep this low? Because as the Fed pumps money into the economy, it's trying to push that down. But eventually the markets are going to get an expectation of inflation, and already the markets are skittish as hell about default rates, so that premium is going up too. Furthermore, markets are getting scared of a long-term higher interest rate environment when the Fed does clamp down on the money supply, so R sub M is going up too. So you see that there are natural forces that are tending to tip the yield curve, that march of time of the term to maturity against the yields of debt instruments is going to want to try to push it that way into an upward arc. Look at the yield curve. Look for it. Look for that upward arcing behavior. That will tell you that the future is not bright if you see it. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.